Murray Walker, pleasure to have you back in Australia, and more particularly a place I know you love, Adelaide.
Yeah, I mean, I first came to Adelaide and first came to Australia, in fact, in 1985 for the first Formula One race. Most of us in Formula One, and I mean like about 95%, had never been to Australia. I didn't even know where Adelaide was. I had to get the atlas out and find it. And when we came here, we were absolutely knocked out with the place, with the weather, the brightness of the light, the friendliness of everybody here. Adelaide fitted so well with the Grand Prix, and we had a wonderful race. We came back here for 11 years, and then I thought, oh dear, that's it. But the Clipsal started, and I think this is my eighth time here, and it's a joy to be back.
With, I guess, a cloud over Melbourne's future, I would imagine, are one of the biggest advocates to say bring it back here?
Well, I know nothing about the politics of what's going on at Melbourne, whether it's a sort of power play between Bernie Ecclestone and Rob Walker and the Melbourne politicians. I think everybody, with the greatest of respect to Melbourne, who do an absolutely fantastic job, and I'm not knocking them, Albert Park's a very nice circuit and everybody's very friendly there, but there is a magic about Adelaide, and I think Formula One would love to come back here, but I can't see it happening.
One period that we particularly would like to speak to you about in your life and your career is the turbo era. Can you give us some of your recollections now on what the turbo era meant to Formula One and what it actually meant to you?
Well, probably the answer to that question is the same thing, because the turbo era was gigantically spectacular visually. You had the titanium skid plates at the bottom of the car, and the ride heights were set very low. So you got these great plumes of sparks coming out of the backs of the cars, which were great to look at. From my point of view as a television commentator, I was able to rhapsodise about that. But it was a supreme test of drivers' ability, because the cars were... The Brabham BMW, for instance, when Nelson Piquet was driving and he won the first championship for a turbo car with a Brabham BMW in 1983. They were developing about 1,300 or 1,400 horsepower on the qualifying lap, and the power was like an on-off switch. Once you got nothing, and then all of a sudden you've got the lot. And the tyres would last for one lap if you nursed them. So it was an enormously spectacular and exciting and unpredictable time, because Renault, who had introduced the turbo cars in 1977 when Jean-Pierre Jabouille appeared at Silverstone with one, and it was so unreliable that we all used to call it the yellow teapot, because it was forever brewing up and blowing up. But then Renault slowly got it right, and Alain Prost looked as though he was in line for the championship in 1983, but the car blew up and Nelson Piquet got it. So, very, very exciting time.
Around that time, there was not only this engineering revolution going on, but when we look at the names of the people, and I just made a quick list, Scheckter, Gilles Villeneuve, René Arnoux, Alan Jones, Piquet, Pironi, Mansell, Senna, Prost, Lauda. These names, I don't know how you can liken that period and that amount of quality of driving to now or before.
Well, until 2010, you're absolutely right, you couldn't. I always regarded the 1980s as a golden era, and people used to say, oh, well, you're looking backwards through rose-coloured glasses. But I wasn't, because as you've rightly said, we had Nigel Mansell, we had Nelson Piquet, we had Alain Prost, we had Ayrton Senna, all world champions, all racing against each other. And it was a great, great time. And then, yes, Formula One continued to be good. But frankly, during Michael Schumacher's reign, the opposition wasn't as great and as varied as it had been. But 2010, now 2011, it's a different kettle of fish altogether. Because in 2010, as we know, going down into the last race, any one of four people could have won the championship, and it might conceivably have been five. And there is a quality in depth now that we haven't had for a very long time, as a result of which I confidently predict that 2011 is going to be even better than 2010 was. When you look at, we've got Jenson Button, we've got Lewis Hamilton, we've got Fernando Alonso, Felipe Massa. If Ferrari give him his head and if he's got his self-respect back again, could be in the running. Vettel, Mark Webber, who very nearly won the championship last year. Had Robert Kubica been okay, I would have put him in the hunt. So there's at least six people as of now, before the first Grand Prix, who could win the championship.
We have talked about drivers, we've talked about engineering, but there was a lot of controversy in that turbo era, not only about the cars, but I can think of the 1980 Spanish Grand Prix, which I think has been stricken from the records.
There was an enormous amount of politicking going on because there was a battle for power between the... forgot what they all called themselves in those days, but basically it was between the governing body of the sport and the Constructors Association. And the sport then was the FIA was a very mercurial Frenchman called Jean-Marie Balestre, who was attempting to impose his body's authority on the sport, and he was up against Bernie Ecclestone. I would never want to get involved in any sort of a fight with Bernie Ecclestone because he is the astutest, best politician, most acute financier I have ever met in my life. And in the end, after there'd been a driver's strike in South Africa and we had all this problem in Spain, basically the constructors won out.
We also did have some driver fatalities, most notably Gilles Villeneuve and then Paletti as well a few weeks later. When you have a long run in a sport without deaths, it really does hit even harder, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, immediately after the war finished effectively in 45. But there was quite a long period thereafter where things were almost on a war footing as far as standard of life is concerned and attitudes towards death. And during the war, when not hundreds and not thousands, but millions of people all over the globe had been and were being killed, the attitude towards death was very different to what it is now. And when motor racing began again, it was an exciting way for people to let off steam. The cars were mobile death traps. They had no safety features built into them. The circuits had no runoff. They had no Armco barriers. There was usually a bit of rope between the spectators and the cars. The medical facilities were derisory, and it was not unusual for four or five people to be killed every year. And the attitude then, so close to the end of the war, was the throttle works both ways, and if you don't like the heat, keep out of the kitchen. But then Jackie Stewart started a safety crusade and got no credit for it. In fact, people regarded Jackie Stewart as a wimp for continually advocating greater safety measures. And if he hadn't been world champion and got the respect from everybody because of that, nothing would have happened. But gradually over the years, safety measures have been introduced. And when things got a lot better, but not good enough, and the catalyst for the improvements which have resulted in things being as good as they are now was the death of Senna at Imola in 1994. Senna was, I don't think arguably, Senna was the most famous motor racing exponent who had ever lived, and one of the most famous sportsmen who had ever lived. And by 1994, with the advent of television, it had become a worldwide sport. And Senna was a virtual god in Japan and a virtual god in Brazil, in his own country. And here was this man who millions and millions of people all over the world knew and revered, killed in vision. That wasn't half a wake-up call for Formula One. And Max Mosley, who was the subsequently much reviled head of the FIA, the governing body, did a very courageous and bold thing. He instituted massive, immediate changes after Imola in safety, and they've got better and better and better. And motorsport in general, and Formula One in particular, owes three men a tremendous debt of gratitude, and they are Max Mosley and Bernie Ecclestone and Professor Sid Watkins, who between the three of them have absolutely transformed the safety situation in motorsport to an extent that in the opinion of many people, myself included, it can be seen as too safe, which is a very controversial attitude to have. But these people, myself included, are concerned about the fact that drivers can get in cars now with the virtual certain knowledge that no matter what they do, they're going to be perfectly all right. And this will lead them to drive aggressively, as Senna did, particularly at Japan in 1990, and as Schumacher did throughout his career, notably here in 94 at Adelaide, and then 97 at Jerez, and even in Hungary last year with Rubens Barrichello. And this has engendered an attitude amongst younger drivers who see people like Senna and Schumacher as their role models to drive the same way. But Stirling Moss has said to me many times that in his day, there would never have been any question of drivers adopting the aggressive tactics that they do now, because they would have known that at best they would have been maimed and at worst they would have been killed.
Did you want to go?
I'd like to know that in Adelaide, in those golden era years, that was considered the height of that golden era when you had Senna-Prost rivalry. How lucky was Adelaide to land that golden era, and how did that sort of help develop the race in terms of the mystique?
How lucky was Adelaide? I don't think Adelaide was lucky at all, because my understanding has always been that in 1984-85, when the question of Australia getting a round of the Formula One World Championship arose, there were three contenders, Sydney, Melbourne and Adelaide, of which, and this is what I've been told, there'll be cries of dismay when I say it, my understanding was that Sydney always assumed that it was going to get it because it was Sydney, and Melbourne always assumed that it was going to get it because it regarded itself as the sports capital of Australia, or maybe of the world. Yeah. And maybe they did not try as hard as John Bannon, who was the Premier of South Australia at the time. Adelaide must have been regarded as, and also ran, but John Bannon got in an aeroplane and he flew to London to see Bernie Ecclestone, and that's the sort of thing that Bernie likes. He likes people who take the initiative and show some gumph. And John Bannon did a deal with Bernie, and then he got in another aeroplane and flew to Japan and did a deal with Mitsubishi to sponsor the race. So I don't think Adelaide was lucky. Adelaide fought very hard for what it subsequently proved it richly deserved, because it did an absolutely fabulous job. And like where we came in today, I say that Formula One would love still to be here.
Your involvement directly with that turbo era, because for you, in the commentary box, you got a little Australian invention there about 1979, 1980, which allowed you to see what was going on from the car. What did in-car cameras do to your job, to what John, James was then able to translate and explain audibly, which we were seeing from those pictures?
I mean, technology has transformed world interest in Formula One in general and motorsport in particular. Because when I began, it was radio and there weren't any pictures. But when television began, you just had a camera looking at the cars going round and round and round, and you did the best you could. But you're right, with the advent of the on-car cameras, which incidentally, it was down to Bernie Ecclestone, Formula One has developed the way it has because of the driving force of one man, and that's Bernie Ecclestone. Yes, he's had a lot of support from very important people like Max Mosley and promoters and Ron Walker and all the rest of them, but if it hadn't been for Bernie Ecclestone, the three of us wouldn't be sitting here together. So Bernie was responsible for on-car cameras. Bernie was responsible for creating this machine which televised the Grand Prix, because when it all began, each of the individual countries did their own coverage. I remember the first time I came to Australia in 85, Channel 9 were doing it, and a chap called David Hill was in charge, and he was an absolute genius, and he went on to become one of Rupert Murdoch's head men on television, and as far as I know, he still is. And Channel 9 did an absolutely stupefying job in terms of coverage. Everything in Adelaide that was on television was keyed to Formula One. The cookery programs, the religious programs, the gardening programs, they were all given a Formula One slant, and there were lots of programs explaining what it was all about. And I remember saying to David how knocked out by it all I was. And he said, well, Murray, Australia doesn't very often get any international events. I'm talking about 1985. He said, Australia doesn't very often get any international events, but to get a world championship event is very, very special indeed. And I'm determined that everybody in Australia who wants to know about Formula One shall know everything that they can know about Formula One by the time the race starts at 2 o'clock on Sunday, or whenever it started, and he did a fabulous job. And now, in a situation where, as I say, when television began and I was doing it and it was just cameras looking at the cars, now you've got graphics, you've got sector times, everything's done to a thousandth of a second, you've got captions telling you exactly what's going on, and it's enhanced the enjoyment of television viewing for Formula One enormously, because Formula One is a very difficult sport to follow if you are not steeped in it and knowledgeable about it. For the housewife sitting at home, who isn't particularly, or the sports fan sitting at home, it's very unlike almost any other sport. Aussie rules, rugby, football, cricket, tennis, swimming, athletics, boxing, they all happen in a very confined area, wholly within the sight of someone sitting in a grandstand. That doesn't happen with Formula One. You sit in a grandstand and the cars go around, and a minute and 20 seconds later they come back again, and they're not necessarily in the same order. You can't read the numbers because they're so small because of the sponsors' needs. And if you could read the numbers, you probably wouldn't know who they related to. There's two car batches, McLarens and Renaults and all the rest of it, which look alike. And then they start going into the pits to change tyres and wheels, and you lose touch with things. So you really, 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 with Formula One, need somebody who is explaining what is happening. And with the advent of all the technology that we've got now, I was able to stand in the commentary box, because I always stood, and I had about 5 television screens, which I could get up by punching buttons, which gave me total knowledge about the race. And the more that's going in here in the terms of knowledge, the more comes out of here in terms of information. So that's about a 20-minute answer to your simple question of how has technology changed Formula One.
If I could take you now to where you see the blogging and tweetering and all this new media, of how quickly that information is going from general people out into the masses. What do you think of that?
Well, it's a great thing because, it's increasing the number of people who are interested in and talking about and hypothesizing about and incorrectly predicting what is going to happen. The more people who are interested in it and talking about it.
Going back to the turbo era now, changing again, and we did see the end of one iconic team for an Australian and the other one an iconic team for Formula One, that being Lotus and Brabham. Did their demise cause any ripples in the monster that is Formula One?
Well, sadly, not really. Lotus is still one of the most successful Formula One teams of all time. And with Colin Chapman, it had an iconic genius in charge of it, an iconic genius who would probably be in jail now, incidentally. And I mean that very seriously, because if the DeLorean scandal had run its course and Colin had been alive, he, like Fred Bushell, his finance director, who took the rap, would have been in jail. But anyway, that's an aside and irrelevant to Formula One. Colin Chapman was a genius. He built up a fantastic team with fantastic drivers like Jim Clark and Graham Hill and Mario Andretti and all the rest of them. But sadly, it went under for the usual reason, and that was money. Brabham, Jack was the first person to win a Grand Prix in a car carrying the driver's name. He did an absolutely fantastic job, and he's an incredible man. Then Bernie took over, and after Bernie sold it on, it was a sad husk of its previous self, and all sorts of dubious people were in charge, and I was very glad that it disappeared altogether. And I am out on a bit of a limb at the moment as far as Lotus is concerned, because to me, the Lotus car of 2010 and 2011 is not Lotus. To me, desirable and laudable as it is, a Malaysian car company owning a new team with no associations with the previous Lotus organization, is not Lotus. And this is not in any way to denigrate Tony Fernandez, who I have nothing but respect and admiration for, but it's always been a bit of a mystery to me why he doesn't call it something of his own. But that's his business and not mine.
Okay. A Freudian slip there will lead me to a question I really want to ask you about. Ron Taranak, can you tell me your involvement with Ron and some stories about him?
Well, I didn't really have any involvement with Ron. I mean, everyone was very conscious of the fact that Jack was the commercial and the driving brains of Brabham, and that Ron Taranak was the design and development brains of Brabham, and that neither could have lived without the other in terms of their enormous success. And Ron was and remains a quiet behind-the-scenes chap who likes to sit at his drawing board producing better cars, which he did with monotonous regularity. And when Ron sold out to Jack Brabham and then started Rault, I think that he did very well, but presumably just got tired of doing it. I haven't got a lot of apocryphal stories about Ron, because Ron's not that sort of a bloke.
John Barnard, Ron Dennis, two fellas and two names in that turbo era that go hand in hand. Of course, Ron's had troubles lately.
Well, how long have you got? Ron Dennis, in his way, is a genius, like Colin Chapman was, like Bernie Ecclestone is, like Enzo Ferrari was. Ron Dennis started his life as a, I was going to say humble mechanic, there's nothing humble about Ron, started his life as Jack Brabham's mechanic, actually. With Neil Trundle, they formed Rondell Racing, Ron for the RON of Rondell for Ron Dennis and the DLE for Neil Trundle. They had quite a lot of success. But Ron is a gigantically commercially minded man, and Neil fell by the wayside quite happily. There was nothing unpleasant about it. And Neil Trundle is currently running the transmission side of McLaren. I mean, one could talk for hours about Ron Dennis when you look at what he has achieved, notably because he had the guts and the financial courage to start his own Formula One project, and that was when he formed his association with John Barnard. And we've had some brilliant, brilliant, brilliant engineers and designers in Formula One, John Barnard, Gordon Murray in particular, and others. And John Barnard it was, of course, who with Hercules produced the first carbon fibre tub, and now everybody's got it. But Ron Dennis and John Barnard were a sort of oil and water situation in terms of personality in many ways, and I suppose it was inevitable that they were going to part company. But it was the two of them who went to Porsche and got them to design an engine for the McLaren, which Mansour OJ of TAG paid for. And that's what really escalated the whole turbo thing, with Ferrari in it, with Renault in it, with BMW in it, and with McLaren in it, and with all the rest of them. So John Barnard's got an enormous amount to be thanked for. And then, of course, he went on to Ferrari and Benetton, and is now designing carbon fibre furniture, if you can imagine anything different from designing chairs with spindly carbon fibre legs to having designed Formula One cars. But like a lot of enormously successful people, John Barnard was a difficult man to work for, because he wanted the way things John Barnard wanted them, and he was right. And Ron Dennis doesn't suffer fools gladly either. But when I was talking about Colin Chapman and the famous drivers he had been associated with, but when you look at the drivers and the combinations of drivers that Ron Dennis has been associated with, notably Senna and Prost and Häkkinen and all the rest of them, it's a most amazing situation. And I think that Ron Dennis and McLaren were outrageously treated by the FIA over that $100 million fine of theirs, and it resulted in Ron Dennis outwardly leaving the sport. I'm sure he has a lot to do with it behind the scenes with Martin Whitmarsh. In an ironic way, it was a good thing, because now McLaren are making the most incredible road cars, the first of which, the M12C, is going to be one of many to come.
Talk now that the turbocharger might return, and I'm wondering, are you with Bernie that it's the wrong decision, or are you in favour of something like that coming back?
I think it's the right decision in terms of Formula One being seen to be politically in tune with the rest of the world and pollution and all that stuff, which gives me a pain in the neck. But I think, sadly, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think Formula One is going to be the spectacle with what are they going to be, 1.6 litres or 1.4 litres, whatever it is, droning away quietly in the background in comparison with 18, 19,000 RPM cars which we have now, because noise is one of the great attractions of Formula One. So I think that politically, probably it's a very good thing. I fear, however, from the point of view of the sport as a spectacle, that it may turn out to be a bad thing. But then, whenever I make a prophecy, it usually turns out to be wrong, so I hope I am on this occasion.
So do you have a tip, firstly, for the Clipsal 500, who's going to win tomorrow, and also for the Melbourne Grand Prix?
I don't really know enough about V8 supercars to be able to predict a win, partly because I don't know enough, partly because I think it's unpredictable. I mean, Jamie Wincup seems to be the man to beat at the moment here at Adelaide, as I talk to you, and he won one of the races at Abu Dhabi, and he's been 3 times winner here, so he would have to be a favourite from my point of view. James Courtney has got a lot to prove. He's changed his team. He's got the most successful teammate in the history of V8 supercars to try to beat. Craig Lowndes has got a habit of continually coming up with the goods. Jamie Wincup, as I say. Jason Bright could get it done. Mark Winterbottom could get it done. It really is unpredictable, so who knows?
And Melbourne?
Melbourne. Well, I can safely say now that I confidently predict that any one of about 7 people could win the race. I mean, we don't really know after four series of tests for Formula One what the form is. We've got Kers, we've got the movable rear wing, they're all on Pirelli tyres, which have been designed to degrade quickly in order to make Formula One more interesting and exciting. Red Bull look as though they may be slightly ahead of the rest, but Ferrari are there too. McLaren haven't gone well, but McLaren will get things right. Ferrari look as though they're in good shape. Renault have got a good car. Mercedes look as though they've got their car up to speed. So you've got Alonso, Massa, Button, Hamilton, Schumacher. Can Schumacher get the job done? Yes, in my opinion, he can. A lot of people in Britain are very derisory about Schumacher now, but he's 7 times world champion. It's like riding a bicycle. You don't forget how to do it. You get a bit rusty. And when you've been out for 3 years and things have changed as much as they have, it takes a lot of getting up to speed. Well, I think he's up to speed now. He didn't have a car worthy of his talent last year. It looks as though he will have this year. Nico Rosberg is a lot better than people give him credit for. So all I can say about Melbourne is that hopefully it's going to be a fantastic race, and it's going to be the precursor of a hell of a lot of changes because of the specification changes and because of the drivers.
Are you going to be able to get to it?
I'm literally going to be able to get to it because the BBC is doing a 60-minute television programme on my life and times, and they wanted to get some up-to-date footage of me at the Grand Prix, so I'm going there on Tuesday, but I will be going back to England on Friday, so I will have been at Albert Park, but I'll be sitting at home like the rest of us watching it on the box.
And last year I watched a few of your webcasts on the BBC. Will you be continuing that sort of work?
Yes, I'm doing that again. I'm continuing to write a column for F1 Racing. I'm continuing to have a starring role in Rory the Racing Car. Do you know about Rory the Racing Car?
You mean Conrad, Craig Lowndes?
No. I'm talking, it's the kids.
Yeah, Craig Lowndes was Conrad.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, yeah, that's right, that's it. So I'm still...
It's huge here.
Yeah, oh, is it? Yeah, I'm still fairly busy.
Yeah. Did you get a gig in Cars too? Because they're all over in Europe in this episode of Cars.
They were going to use me as a commentator, but for whatever reason, it just all suddenly went quiet and it didn't happen.
Murray, it's always a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.